But yeah, so today I want to talk with you guys about sort of something that I think is really important, especially in this time of rebuilding, and that's, you know, around the concept of how do we serve the church? How do we actually serve the community? And I think that serving is something that's often misunderstood, is kind of like this thing that we do. Evan, do you mind shutting those doors? Because it's so cold in here. Yeah, I think that serving is something that we often do as like a way of kind of, you know, as I like to call it, easing the nagging voice of conscience. It's like, it doesn't come out, it's not flowing out of our love for Jesus as much as often it can flow. And I think we've all probably had these experiences in church where it's like, you feel like guilty that you're not doing more. And so all of a sudden it becomes sort of what I say is one of the deep problems and what Luther felt was essential to the Christian faith, which is the ability to distinguish between law and gospel. And it's what I call in my book is the difference between ladder theology and cross theology. Ladder theology is the attempt to climb toward a particular goal. And it really is the mean, it's the systems that the world still adheres to. It's what every religion adheres to. Do these things and you will be right with God, or do these things and you'll achieve this. And it's steps, it's programs, it's curriculum, and it tends to be prescriptive. And the problem with ladder theology is that it almost always depends upon a guru who's more arrived or more further spiritually along than the rest. And so we often turn our pastors into those, and pastors often present themselves as that. And I think it's why we see so many pastors in the church fall, because they are trying to present to the church an ideal that they themselves can't live up to. And what happens when we create ladder theology in the church is it exhausts people. It ends up creating a works-based salvation, although we would never say that. And any, you know, evangelical Christian's going to say that they're saved by grace and all those things, but that's often not how we live. And so there's a real challenge and a danger when we talk about service if we don't keep it anchored in the gospel. Because it's much easier. And I will say this, I said it at the end of the sermon today, and wasn't planned, it just kind of came to me in the moment. It is easier to give than it is to receive. For most of us, it's easier to it's awkward to accept something, to accept help, because to receive is you saying that you need help. You know, especially like when it comes to the gospel, it's like salvation is built upon this idea that you're lost and you can't save yourself. Service is often a way of us trying to circumnavigate that reality. And that's where service can get real ugly in the church. And it's also, I shouldn't say it gets ugly, it's what creates burnout in the church, is that service becomes a way of us trying to find our self-worth. Some of you, you know, there's a million, people are obsessed with personality tests right now, and everything from DISC to Myers-Briggs to Enneagram and, you know, everything in between. I think it's always dangerous to try to diminish existence to 9 numbers or 4 types. But obviously there's truth in all of them. And there are certain temperaments that find their deepest value in serving people. And that's a beautiful thing. That's just a way that God has hardwired you. In fact, we're even told that that's actually a gift of the Spirit. In 1 Corinthians. So service is actually a spiritual gift. But I think it's dangerous when we read the gifts of the Spirit. It's really, there's a singular gift, and the gift is the Spirit himself, and the Spirit is sovereign. And I actually think that the gifts of the Spirit are, what I pray for is, Holy Spirit, I want you to have your way in me. So I'm like, I'll take it all. Give me a word of prophecy. Give me knowledge. Make me an evangelist. Like all those things, like, it's you, it's your work to do in me as I submit to you. Service is one of those areas as well. It's like, it's we must choose to say yes to God's yes. And that isn't just a one-time event. It's the repeating the yes of love. That's what I always tell people in a marriage covenant. The repeating of the yes of love is that it's not just me saying I love Darcy, and it's not me, like, I don't win as a husband because I didn't have an affair. Like, met plenty of marriages where there weren't affairs, but they were dead marriages. And it's because there was a refusal to repeat the yes of love. They didn't do the things necessary to keep love as a central focus of, I'm going to know this person. And that's the funny thing about the gospel is it carries all the same principles as human relationship. It's like, you know, marriage, the goal is not arrival. The marriage, the goal is knowing. And you keep knowing, and you keep knowing on a deeper level. Darcy is an enigma that I love to continue to get to know deeper and deeper. And it's amazing, like, you know, and going through things like we did with the counseling, like that, those things opened up my mind to like how much more someone can be known, and how we actually, when we refuse to come into the light, when we refuse to serve one another, it stunts that growth. And so if service is something you keep in mind as A, it's something that can be supernaturally empowered. We're told in scripture that we have not been given a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of self-control. And we also think of it in terms of the choice that we are given as a people who have been set free. So I would say that the non-believer, the person who has not crossed from life to death, is still dead in their sins. They don't actually have freedom because they're dead. It's the believer that has freedom, and freedom actually creates the possibility of failure. So as my daughter, you know, grew in as a little girl, we lived across the street from Abernathy Elementary. When she was 3, I didn't let her go play at Abernathy by herself. When she was 5, I let her go play with her brother, and I still was paranoid. I would watch out the window. When she was 7, I let her go play with her friends. When she was 10, I let her go over to the park by herself. You know, when she was 13, now she's 15, and I let her go hang out at night. And sometimes she calls and says, can we stay out till 11? And she wanders around Southeast Portland in the dark, and it terrifies me, but it's part of actually allowing my child to become an adult. So the more they mature, the more freedom they're given, but the more freedom they're given is the greater the possibility that she does something dumb or something happens. And so it's there's the more you grow in Jesus, the more freedom you are given, but the more freedom you have creates the greater possibility of failure in that freedom. And that's why there's a power that, like, there's a power in understanding that when God says, when Jesus says he sets you free, it's not freedom to do whatever we want, it's the freedom to begin to do what is right, which is to draw near to him. So I think of this verse in 12:1. So this is the passage in Romans that I think is really the central passage, and you know, we'll be there in a couple months, but it's been a key passage for me throughout my Christian life of balancing what salvation and sanctification and how they're intertwined. And he says, Paul says, you know, based upon everything I've said to you over the last 11 chapters, and it weren't chapters, it was just a letter. So after everything I've said to you, that would have been, by the way, read in its entirety in a church service, that would have been the sermon. It's just someone reading Paul's letter. And then everyone's being like, what is he talking about? And people are like, I don't know. And then everyone arguing about it for 2,000 years. But he's like, based on everything that I've just said to you about what the gospel is, and let's now consider its implications. And he says, I beseech you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Now, that phrase, reasonable service, it's actually translated multiple ways. It can also be translated logical worship or practical worship. And so we have a fundamental misunderstanding of what worship is because of our tendency to define worship as a to define worship as, you know, a thing that you do before the sermon starts, or it's the, or maybe you have a little more robust vision of worship. It's something that you do during service when you gather together. But worship really is the eternal occupation of every believer. That's why I say it begins with submission. It's initiated by the Spirit. It's defined by truth, and it's expressed in love. And so when we think in terms of service as a, as an act of worship, it infuses it with a really beautiful meaning. And I think of one of the first books I read as a Christian. How many of you guys have read Brother Lawrence's book, Practicing the Presence of God? It's a little tiny slim volume. I'm not even sure. Nick, do you know when that was written? Yeah, I think it was like, I want to say it was like 16th or 17th century. Like he's basically just a Catholic monk. What little we know of him, it seems like he had like a lame foot. One of his primary roles was just doing the dishes at the monastery. But it was a really powerful thing. Today, after the sermon, someone came up to me and said, I realize that my idolatry, that I've made music my first, in the regard to the principle of first and second things, he's like, I've made music the first thing, and I've been angry with God that he hasn't blessed it, and that COVID has so messed up my ability to make income because I can't play the shows right now, and it's the only thing I'm good at, and it's the only thing I want to do. And that frustration, that it's the chasing after the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, that is a maddening pursuit, and you will never get there. It's what I say. It's why we're so offended when our celebrities take their own lives, because celebrities represent the pinnacle of human achievement. It's like they've made it all the way to the top of the food chain, and we're still struggling to get to base camp. And then they get all the way to the top of the mountain, and it's like they get to the summit, and they look back down at us and say, there's nothing up here, and then jump to their deaths. That's the picture that I have. And it's like, we're not upset because we love them. We're upset because they took something for granted that we think we would treat differently. And it kind of shows the vanity of living life for something that is always slightly out of reach. And serving is a way of grounding us in the mundane, the ordinary, and it actually is the means by which we can find beauty in those things. So Brother Lawrence talked about, like, when he did the dishes, like, he found it as a place of communion for Jesus. It's all about what I use the phrase, the framework of sacramental caste. Probably sounds, someone came up to me and said that they're like, are you a big fan of Anglicans? I noticed you use the language of sacramental caste, and I'm not necessarily a big fan of Anglicans. I'm just a big fan of Harry Blamires, who wrote the book, The Christian Mind. And one of the chapters is a sacramental caste, and it just gave me a language for something that's really important to me, which is the ability to attune one's mind in existence toward the presence of God in everything. I'm not talking about a pantheistic worldview where God is in everything and a part of everything. I'm saying seeing God's sustaining presence, his actual personal presence, that being the driving factor of my existence. It's what C.S. Lewis said of George MacDonald, that he lived so fully aware of the presence of Christ that he could see a fairy in every flower. If you've never read MacDonald's fairy tales, literally you have not actually lived yet. So I can't recommend him highly enough. Like, I agree with Lewis so fully. No one has baptized my imagination like MacDonald. But that picture of, like, service actually as a means of worship, as a means of intimacy with Jesus, is so powerful. And what did Jesus himself say? The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to what? To serve, to lay down his life for many. And so here you have this principle of our reasonable service is not our willingness to choose to serve. It's our willingness to choose to be servants. That's the key. When you choose to serve, you are in control of when and when that does not happen. When you choose to be a servant, that is actually taking on an identity that defines now your existence. It's a very different way of thinking about it. And choosing to be a servant is actually finding that our life finds its greatest value when it's lived for others, when it's lived for something bigger than ourselves. And that's, you know, in the introduction to my book, I talk about this idea of, like, why would I even be willing to write memoir? Why do I feel the need to share my childhood stories? And it's a terrifying process, honestly, because it was a very painful thing to write. But it's the fundamental belief that my life, like yours, actually matters significantly. And that our lives have shared experiences. So when we read someone's story, there is a universal reality to it. It doesn't matter how different they are. There's just things you're one of my favorite authors is this guy named Carl Ove Nosgard, and he wrote a 5,000-page, 6-volume set that they released one a year starting in about 2011. And I just, it came out every summer. It had all come out in Norwegian before, but they finally started releasing it years later. It became this phenomenon. I think one in eight Norwegians read all 6 volumes. I think it's the most popular books ever written in Norway, like more so than Ibsen, which is crazy. But it's 6 volumes of this guy's memoir in unbelievable, at times boring detail. Around his relationship with his father, his divorce, his remarriage, his childhood, abuse, all these things, music, 100-page diatribe on cleaning a bathroom after his dad died. I mean, it's insane. But I could not put it down. I think I read each volume as it came out in the summer within a week. Like, they're that readable. But it's because he creates the universal voice, the universal experience, something that can be known and experienced. I think that longing to be connected to the universal, that universal voice, what it means to be human and what it means to be image bearers, is most fully experienced when we enter into other people's lives. So we can do that through a book, but it's so much more powerful to do that through serving one another, through actually making a difference in another person's life. And it frees us from the tyranny of self-love. That's the thing of choosing to be a servant frees you from the tyranny of self-love. And nothing is a greater tyrant than that. A lot of people really struggle with this idea of the death of self. But a biblical vision of the death of self is found right here in Romans 12:1. Present yourselves as living sacrifices. This is a daily command to basically say, not my will be done, but thy will be done. All he's really doing is expanding on Jesus' own command on how to pray. Our Father who's in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Because the essence of human existence has always been driven by this idea of my will be done. My will be done. That's the essence of sin. The Christian life, we find our freedom from that sin most fully when we live for others. And so it can't just be choosing to serve keeps you selfishly in control. Choosing to be a servant is taking on an identity, a daily posture by which Jesus is going to be king, and he is most honored, and we are most satisfied when our lives are poured out for him and for others. And that's where I just come back again and again to Martin Buber's I and Thou, is that you can't look away from your neighbor without looking away from God. I just was meeting with a woman that's been at Door of Hope for 10 years now, and it was a really sweet meeting, and just her, you know, wrestling with, like, should I go to another church? Is Door of Hope where I want to continue to be? And she came to the conclusion, she's like, I don't even know why I was even thinking about leaving. This is where my community is. And it was all around, like, it was just the lies that she began to believe over a year and a half of isolation, of just loneliness. Loneliness is a major theme right now. when the church actually learns to become servants, where we take on the identity of servants, people won't be lonely. Not in the same way, because a servant all of a sudden has a much, much larger worldview, because they are smaller in the world. That's Chesterton's whole principle. How much larger would the world be if you were smaller in it? And so it's the beauty of the little acts. It's the beauty of entering in to the mundane and allowing it to be transformed into something sacred. It's the power of the smallest act. I mean, I've just discovered this. Like, I used to always make my wife coffee in the morning, and now we drink different coffees. And so I realized, like, part of me making coffee for her is because I'm gonna make coffee for myself anyway. But now I have to make it for her, and I'm not even gonna drink what she's drinking. So that's like it takes like, you know, 10 extra minutes. I'm trying to wake up. I just want to drink my own coffee. But the joy, she wakes up every day at 6:15. And when I bring in a French press into the bedroom, my wife is like a total ritual queen. Like, she is like seriously, she might be a witch. I'm joking. But she loves candles. She loves her incense. She loves her ritual. She loves the chair that she does her devotions in. And to bring in a French press, set it down, take her little space heater, set it up, turn it on, light two candles. Seriously, I just won. I won all week. I am like master and commander now for the day because of this little, it took nothing, but it brings her so much joy and it makes her feel so loved that it's like our relationship is a million times better just because this little dumb, what seems insignificant, but it has unbelievable significance because it's a way that she feels loved. All people, we all want to know that we're loved, that we're appreciated. There's nothing wrong with that. But too often we're looking for it in ourselves and we never get it. It's when we actually turn it outward toward the community as a whole that people actually find their needs being met. You will feel cared for when someone in the church serves you, when someone in the church. And so there has to be a willingness to give, but there also has to be a willingness to receive. And I think it's a push and pull reality. And I think that this is the power. It's the call to servanthood is the call to function seamlessly. And I think that that's what it means when it says that we present our bodies over to Christ. It's really turning over to Christ ourselves and all that we have. And so one way, like people ask, like, how can I serve the church? If you guys were going to ask me, like, what in my mind does it mean to be a member of Door of Hope, even though we don't have formal membership? I would say, number one, that you show up. You are serving the church and you are serving the kingdom of God by coming to church. And not necessarily the foundations class, but literally just coming every Sunday, making that a priority, that this is something that your soul needs and your community needs you. And the witness of Jesus happens most fully when God's people come together. So you are playing a part in the gospel going forth. Every time you show up, you are choosing to not sleep in. You are choosing to not let your kids who may be young and toddlers control your energy level. But you're going to know, in spite of that, this is actually a priority for us. One way that you can serve this church is just by being here. Like it's not church without you. It's kind of true. I actually just had this horrible nightmare the other night that we were in Revolution Hall, except there were two auditoriums, and a friend's church, I won't name the church, were using the other auditorium in my dream, and it was right before service, and nobody was in we had changed auditoriums, and none of our people were there. There was like 10 people in the room, and I started having panic attacks, so I go over to my friend's church, which is like literally in the dream, because they don't make sense, is across the hallway in a really big auditorium, and everyone's in there, and all of our people are in this other church. And there's a guy, a pastor that I know named John Tyson, and he was weirdly the pastor of this church. And I ran into several people. Piper, you were there. You abandoned me in my dream. You were one of the people there, and you're like, I'm just checking it out. And then I saw another friend. I'm like, what's going on? She's like, I'm sorry, Josh. I just really like John Tyson, and I think I'm going to go here for a while. It's a really bad dream. It was pretty bad dream. It just shows it isn't church without the family. It's not church without the family. And of course, my dream was more about insecurities and people leaving and choosing someone else over me. And this has more to do with childhood trauma. But the fact is that church isn't church without people there. And so one way that you can serve is to be here, to participate. In the way that you can serve, honestly, this is something that's really, really big to me. I was just talking with Mel about this. It's like, it's coming in with the anticipation that you're going to meet with Jesus. You are serving the body and you are serving Christ when you come ready to meet with him. And you come ready to meet with him with your community, with your family. And it's creating, I think, one of the first acts of service, it's presenting your body as a living sacrifice. He says, this is your reasonable service. This is your logical worship, is actually coming with an attentiveness to the Holy Spirit. I want a greater attentiveness to the Spirit at Door of Hope. I want to see more space for the Spirit to move us into that posture of servanthood. Not, I'm going to let the Spirit convict me that I haven't done anything, and so this week I'm going to do that so I don't feel guilty. That's not what Jesus wants. What he wants is a posture of a servant. And so being here is one way that you can serve Door of Hope. Just coming. Just show up. Make the average person, the average millennial, goes to church maybe once to twice a month. So any given Sunday, we are missing. And literally, COVID, we still have no idea. I'm feeling like we're getting a pretty good idea, but COVID cut Door of Hope in half. Whether or not, you know, people have gone on to different churches or whether people just still haven't come back to church, there's probably some that still call Door of Hope their home church but just haven't come back because they're nervous about COVID. That's all possibility. But I think we're starting to see where things are going to land. And I'm fine with that because I believe God is still on the throne and I believe that all we can do is what we do, be as faithful as possible and learn from the ways that we haven't created the space for people to be a community that serves and be clear about the ways that we can moving forward so that we can actually be committed to one another, covenantally committed. So showing up to Sunday, being involved in a community group is a way that you can serve the church because once again, community groups are the ways in which you are can know and be known. Don't undervalue what God has blessed you. You won't even know where you're gifted until you actually move into community with someone. You're not going to the best way that people discover what their gifts are is actually in the context of community. You know how I discovered I was a preacher? Was through touring and telecast, and I'm playing songs, and I found myself sharing between songs. And I found that the sharing got longer and longer, and the set got shorter and shorter. And I had people come up to me dozens of times and say, I think you might be a preacher. And it had never even crossed my mind. But I was in the context of nightly playing concerts in front of God's people, even though it wasn't one local church. But it was the gift was identified by other believers. If you're wondering how God has uniquely hardwired you to contribute to the community, that's not going to be discovered in isolation. In fact, I never trust self-identifying prophets or like when people come to me and say, the Lord told me I'm supposed to be a worship leader here. And I would ask Evan, I'd be like, Evan, has the Lord told Evan you're supposed to be a worship leader yet? You should probably talk with him first. You should probably try out because we don't even know if you can sing. At the end of the day, if you're going to be a worship leader, we do want people to want to listen to your voice. And so, I mean, there's like practical things that you aren't going to know unless you get, and there's gifts that you may have that haven't even been uncovered because you still are living in isolation. So being, if this many people in the church took being a servant in the community seriously, it could change the dynamic of the whole community. I mean, it takes a small portion of the church to actually radically shift the entire ethos of the church. And historically, friends, just to be clear, the church has always been carried on the shoulders of a few. Always. It's just how it goes. There is always going to be a mass number of casual listeners. Not that they're not believers, but the more a church enters into the posture of servanthood, the more opportunity we have to draw people out of the casual and bring them into the fervent. And so it takes a small amount. If a little leaven can leaven the whole lump, a little leaven of Holy Spirit righteousness can also leaven the whole lump. The principle can be reversed. It only takes a single match to light a dark room. So I think that's the thing. We don't have to be discouraged in a city like Portland that's so unchurched. That's why I think Door of Hope has the ability to shine so brightly. And so I think that this is something that we need to understand. And then I think that understanding of the expression of servanthood functioning sacrificially, not only can you come and just be a part of it, get into a community group, come to service, but then there are the practical ways, as choosing to be a servant, that you then participate in the different ways. Come to morning prayer. Mel's, you know, this is something I love, that I'm moving toward this more and more. It used to be attempt to kind of control, like we don't want to do things unless a pastor can be there. And so it would limit things. And there's risk taking, obviously, and just handing over ministries to people, to lay people. But there's a beauty in that messiness. That's the reason that Jesus said to his disciples, greater things will you do than what you've even seen me do, because I go to my Father. Why? Because up to that point, he is one man in one place, the Spirit-filled God-man. But he's saying, my Spirit now is going to fill every person that puts their faith in him. That power of Jesus' ability to replicate himself in entire communities by the presence of his Spirit in each of your lives means that we can actually do so much more ministry. In early days of Door of Hope, the reason I entered into 8 months of severe anxiety is because I felt like things wouldn't happen unless I was in the center of it. And it was fun. It was, don't get me wrong, I loved being like utilizing my charisma to just be a catalyst for things. And I had a lot of energy for it. So it's like, you know, I constantly were doing 30 days of more, like, I mean, I made Tim Mackey teach through the entire New Testament with me at 6 a.m. over 3 months. Monday through Friday. We did that for 3 months, the entire New Testament. I think I taught the entire book of Romans for 3 months by myself, like in 2016 at 6 a.m. But those things are not sustainable. and that's what, like, Mel and Gene came up and were like, hey, we actually have the energy, and there's something happening in the prayer time, and we want to serve the community by it. But we know that that's not something that you or it'll burn the staff out. So can we take that on every other month? And I'm like, yes. what's going to happen? I mean, how can that go wrong? I mean, you kind of can't go wrong praying. And so I think that this is the beauty. So if you guys have ideas of ways, if you see holes, this is the thing that often is really hard for me, is that people are more than willing to actually point out the holes that they see in the church, but they aren't necessarily willing to do anything about it. They want me to fix it. Or there's an expectation, there's like a need. What are you gonna do about, I'm so tired of being asked, like, what are you gonna, like, what's your plan for discipleship? I'm like, it's the same stinking plan I've had since I started the church. I'm gonna point people to Jesus in the way that I'm hardwired to do so. I'm like, the moment you're a born again believer and Jesus becomes your center, you are a disciple. So, like, if it's not going the way that you want it to go, then start doing what you think should be done. If you see a hole in what I'm doing, then fill the hole. That's what it means to be a servant. And being servants is much more helpful to me than being critics. Because I don't know that the church needs more critics. We need prophetic voices that are willing to say, hey, that's not the word of the Lord, of course. But when it comes to critiquing, you know, we need more structure on this, or I came up in Campus Crusade for Christ, this is how we should do it. Or I did Navigators, that's how we should do it. I feel like I have less and less patience for people that are coming in with an agenda because they think that they've got it figured out on how to do it right. I want people to serve the church because they love Door of Hope and they accept it with all of its blemishes. And they're like, I'm here because I'm here, not because I think I'm gonna be the person that, too many people, I've just over time I just don't have patience for agendas. It's like it just isn't helpful. And if you're a person who basically you're here because you think that Door of Hope isn't doing anything right, and you might be the person to change that, that this probably isn't the church for you. But if this is a place where you're like, I just love this church, and I see the messes, I see the holes, but that's why I'm here. I want to help fill those because I love it, not because I think I'm the answer to it. It's that you're one component of being an answer and a solution that requires the whole community. So serve Sunday. Children's ministry always needs volunteers. We're not asking people to serve every Sunday. It would mean that you miss a Sunday service once a month. Is that about right, Brittany? Yeah. If it's once every 2 months that you can serve, but if that's an area that you can serve, and maybe that's an area that you could be trained in, it's like of giving yourself to the kids, serving in the worship community, being involved with PIP, with Alpha, Chelsea, who's like runs a million things with all of the Sunday services from greeting to communion. There's a lot of things. I think foundations classes like this is a blueprint that I think is actually really healthy for the church, but it's not something I can do every week and maintain sanity. But there's people that I'm interested in, like, okay, let's raising up more teachers. Let's raise up more, all those things. People that care about prayer, people that have a heart for helping people understand the role of the Holy Spirit, people that want to serve the homeless. There's all these areas. You uniquely bring your own set of passions that flow out of the way that God has hardwired you. They don't help anyone if they just stay in your head. And they don't serve the community if they aren't made known. And maybe you haven't even discovered where your gifting is because you haven't entered into the community yet. But I promise you, the Spirit is generous in His desire to bless you with His presence. And I should be a living example of that. I am a guy that barely got out of high school. I had literally a 1.7 grade point average when I graduated. And I was an absolute disaster. God takes the most ridiculous things to utilize them to confound the wise. Door of Hope is a motley crew. That's why I love it. And I think that all of us have things to offer. I think about the faithfulness of the crew that comes every week from Union Gospel Mission, and they're like amazing. These guys are like guys who come out of prison, and they're like in love with Jesus. I'm like, if I could just take their zeal and infuse it into everyone in the church. You guys know Lewis, who used to come, he goes to Northeast, but he's the one that sits in the front and goes, Jesus! And like, I'm like, why can't everyone just have that kind of passion? Like, because he knows what he's been saved from. And I think that's where the taking the posture of the servant is actually taking the risk to believe that God actually does want to utilize you to change other people's life. He doesn't just want to change your life. He wants to change other people's lives through your life, which will change your life. That's what changes your life. It's when you become a conduit of grace in another person's life. So serve in the different ways. Another piece that we don't talk about a lot at Door of Hope, but we should, and it's a problem right now, and I'm going to have to address it soon, but we are, because of COVID and because we did 5 new hires at once and our church has been cut in half, we actually were like perfect through, like we didn't see really any drop in giving. And we haven't seen a significant drop, but when we added the new hires, I mean, it pushed us over budget significantly. And we've had tremendous savings. And believe me, we're in better shape than we've ever been. I mean, we've been in way sketchier waters before. When we hired Tim Mackey, we did not have the money to pay him. I just said, I don't care. I promise this guy will pay for himself. and he did. And there's times where the church has to walk by faith, and we by no means want to be a bank. Like, we're not just trying to like stockpile money. We want to put it to ministry work, which we're doing, but we've been in the hole for months now, like since back in May, and we've depleted like down like 100, like the trajectory's not good. And so like we've got to, and I know that the church has what is necessary to support it. And I think some people stopped giving when COVID created confusion of like, the staff was so small that people felt like their needs couldn't be met. And so there's a double risk. People stop giving if they don't feel like they're being cared for. And then you hire people, but then that raises up your budget. And then it's like, people need to give more to make that happen. And so it's, I mean, it's, we forget that like this doesn't this beautiful space doesn't just sustain itself. And we are blessed with unbelievable equity in two buildings that are combined probably worth close to $8 million. And we only owe like $1 million on this one. And we only owe like $300,000 on the other one. So, I mean, we have incredible real estate and value and equity that will allow us to strategically be able to plant churches in the future. But we still have to support the ministry. I'm not interested in laying off any staff. I won't. I would go to extreme measures before that happened. And I don't think we'll need to, but we do need to see an uptick. And some of you are new to the church and still figuring out if this is the place you want to be. And if it is, that's a part of it. And the thing is this, you're not going to hear me talk about it a lot because it's just not my MO. We get too many young people, and I don't want their only experience at church is me railing on them to give money because it just won't even get it. I didn't even know that giving was a thing when I got saved. I actually never even crossed my mind how the church paid for anything. It was like 6 months went by. They didn't hand out an offering plate, and so I didn't know. And then later, I found out, and then my wife wasn't a believer. It's not like she was going to be like stoked on me saying, hey, I think we should give 10% of our money to the church. She'd be like, hell no. So it took me 2 years before I started giving, which is really normal if you're a brand new believer. And we have a lot of new believers right now in the church. So like as a mature believer, like the church has always been sustained by a very small portion of people. And we don't have any really like massive givers in the church. The beautiful thing of Door of Hope is it's actually sustained by pretty like just consistent, you know, modest gifts from people. Nobody on our staff is making outrageous salaries. We try to take good care of our staff. I actually love to see the staff paid better. Just to be totally honest, like I have not gotten a merit raise in over 6 years, and I'm fine with that. I feel totally blessed, and I get to do stuff for Luis Palau, and there's other ways that I'm able to sustain my income. But I want to see our church be generous because I want to do more ministry. I want to buy more churches. I want to plant more churches. And I think that we have to want that together. I can't want that by myself. That needs to be something that we desire and we believe, and we believe that there's good stewardship, and there is. We have a new finance committee in place. Like Russ has done an amazing job, but now that we have two locations, we have a finance committee that's made up of actually not only financial people from the church, both churches, Northeast and Southeast, but we also have two outside, one CPA that will do audits of the church, and then we have a guy named Ken Weigel who's just a really amazing consultant that works at the Bible Project that's on that financial committee and is a consultant to the elder boards. And so very, very tight parameters, healthy. We're on a spending freeze right now as a staff, so there's been instruction like no pastoral care money right now to try to get things leveled out. That's something, I mean, it would be stupid for me to not talk about service and not talk about that because it is a real need. And like I said, it's hard to ask for help. But it's not hard for me to ask for help when I'm looking at the church and what we're able to do as a community. And so I think these are the ways that we can function as a community that lives in service. So really the main principle is this: choose to be a servant. Don't just choose to serve. The ways that you can serve are really simple. Show up. Come to Sunday. Come to morning prayer. Be in a community group. And then be involved, be known, and you will become known, and you will know when you engage. Serve on the welcome team, serve in the children's ministry, and I promise you the reward of serving out of a place of, I serve because my King served me by dying for me, that when the gospel informs it, when it flows out of our heart's affections, not I feel guilty, therefore I need to. And that's the difficult thing of talking about service. It's hard to talk about it, especially money. That's an interesting one. I don't want any of you to give out of guilt. I want you to give because you believe in what God is doing here. And I don't want you to serve out of guilt. I want you to serve because you believe in what God is doing here. And I'm not even worried if you don't serve because Alphonse will do everything. Alphonse should not be the only person doing, seriously, sir. Coffee. I don't know many trips I see you go downstairs with coffee cups. It's great physical conditioning too. And I have been there when I watched a person drop an entire tray at the Northeast Building. If you guys have ever been to the Northeast Building, all the coffee mugs were hand selected by me over a 3-month period, all from the 70s, very specific, like Japanese mugs, and a whole, just probably like 100 mugs, like just broken in one, and I was devastated, so upset. That's why we do white mugs here, because I can't emotionally handle the breakage of antiques. I even wrote a poem for the mug wall at the other building that told people to please stop taking my mugs and replacing them with your ugly Christmas gifts, because I know that I did not buy that thing. Be like the Target, like Snoopy mug. I'm like, where did that come from? So, you guys, you're serving by just being here. So thank you for participating. I want to just open this up to just time, just some questions for the next 10, 15 minutes. And if you have specific questions about how you can serve.